Yvonne not do that. It's really, I'm very fortunate to have been a physician for all of my life, really. And I'll tell you a little bit about my story, because I was a family doc for 25 years, and it was in the time where we delivered babies and saw patients in the hospital, assisted on surgery. Those, they don't do that anymore. And I did that for 25 years. And then I was in urgent care for 13 years. And then I spent 8 months in New Zealand looking at a different model of healthcare delivery, because I was interested, you know, ours isn't working so great. How do they do it in other countries? And when I came back and making the round through my buddy's offices and everything, I went through the waiting rooms, and I was shocked by the how sick the patients were in the waiting rooms and the primary care offices. When I was young and a young family doctor, our patients weren't that sick. That's why I was able to take care of them, you know. They're much more complicated now, and you start to wonder, well, what is it? Is it? And I started looking into that, and diet is such a big part of it. So much of it is preventable, but that's why I have kind of transitioned into this. And I'm the medical director of lifestyle and wellness at Harden. And so let's go ahead and get started. But what I want to cover today is really just so that people have a basic idea of the science behind what we're doing and why whole food, plant-based, no oil, and what about the oil, and keto, and paleo, and alcohol, what about that one? And our environment, does that have to weigh into our food choices? And so to set the stage, chronic disease is on the rise, and our environment is deteriorating. There's escalating problems that affect our economy, our climate, and even our future. So I consider this Rome is burning. And so what do we do? We need to act. Who do you believe? And how do you find truth? Well, we need to take care of ourselves first. That means overall wellness. That means our nutritional patterns. It means our exercise. It means how we handle stress and our sense of purpose in life. And since this is a culinary workshop, we're just going to talk about the nutrition part of it. But this class centers on adopting what I believe is the healthiest nutritional pattern for humans, which is whole food, plant-based, no oil. So just moving on to the internet, it's good on one hand because there's a huge amount of information out there, but it also brings confusion and some conflicting messaging, and so we need to have some skills to be able to separate truth from what is really just promotional, something that somebody is trying to make some money out of. And first, I think you should start with just your own common sense. If a study or a claim sounds, if it makes sense, that's one thing, but if it sounds outlandish or too good to be true, probably is. And then second, take a look at who funds the studies that are used for the basis for promoting a diet. Does the someone have a financial stake in the outcome? And then look for where supporting articles were published. Are they published in journals that have editorial boards? Editorial boards are really important. They're experts that read the studies before they're published, before they allow them to be published. Make sure their statistics are right. Make sure their methodologies make sense. And then lastly, get your information from trusted individuals who are trained. Just because someone is a persuasive salesman doesn't mean that they understand the science. So that said, in the United States today, our number one killer is heart disease, and our number two killer is cancer. And if you add heart disease deaths and cancer deaths, that's over half. They make up about 65% of all deaths. And that's impressive, but what is just as important is that what we eat influences whether we get heart disease and cancer and the remaining 35% of death. So let's just look at the two top causes, cancer and heart disease, and here's what we know. We know that heart attacks can be avoided. Observational studies on humans and cities, cities the size of Reno, Nevada, where they have 0 to 2 heart attacks in an entire year. And all you have to do is look at the yellow pages for Reno and look at the cardiologists and see how many cardiologists they have, see how many heart surgeons you have, and you realize our population is doing something very different from these cities that have such low heart rates, heart disease rates. And diet appears to be the most important factor in affecting heart disease, although exercise, stress management, and sense of purpose are important. But the important point is that most of these heart attacks can be avoided, and we know how to do it, and the methods are in your control. And some of the cancers certainly can be avoided. The incidence can be greatly reduced, and that too is in your control. So what else do we know? Well, of the thousands of studies that have been done so far, there's really only one dietary pattern that has been proven to reverse heart disease, and that's whole food, plant-based, no oil. And it's effective in the great majority of patients, up to 90% of them. And on the cancer front, whole food, plant-based can reduce total cancer deaths by 25 to 30%. And primarily that's through its beneficial effect on breast, prostate, and colon cancers. When we take a look at nutritional patterns, including whole food, plant-based, we concentrate mostly on the health benefits like the reduction in heart disease and cancer. But so often, it seems incredible, but so often, that doesn't really motivate people to make changes unless they suffered a scare or a recent heart attack. People tend to think it's a future possibility, maybe it won't happen to me. And to some extent, we say to ourselves, well, if it does happen to me, c'est la vie, that's life. And I want to change that rather fatalistic view, because we can't change our destinies. We do have choices. And by adopting healthy lifestyle patterns, we can add 10 to 15 years to our lives and be healthy and engaged during all of them versus having chronic disease that slowly worsens over the last 10 years and ends in death. Okay, so is that all that there is, just nutritional patterns? No, there's also weight loss, and there are environment. Whole food plant-based is a very effective optimizer of weight, and you don't need to count calories. It's filling, it tastes great, and it's effective. And as more and more data and information are collected on climate change, scientists are correlating more and more our eating habits, our farming practices, with the change that's going on globally with our climate. So what about other dietary patterns? Well, virtually all the diets that are out there are promoted, at least in part, for weight loss. And so let's see how they compare, not only in weight loss, but also let's look at health and the environment. First off, before we start that, every diet that causes weight loss can show short-term health benefits. And these benefits accrue simply by reducing weight, because weight is the risk factor, is a risk factor, and it's also a promoter of chronic disease. So when patients move from obesity down to normalized weight, cholesterol generally improves, blood pressure improves, they feel more energetic. But beyond these immediate health improvements, which are gained only from the weight loss itself, the health benefits don't persist. So before we start, start talking about diets, I want to comment on the SAD diet. That's the Standard American Diet, which I think is appropriately named. And the acronym is pretty good. But that's the diet that we think is causing so much of the problem. It's a diet we need to transition from. And basically what that diet is, it's high in processed foods. And so you think packaged foods, fast foods, convenience foods.
It's high in saturated fats, which promote heart disease, and it's high in refined sugars. So let's compare and contrast diets. And we'll start with whole food plant-based, but look beyond heart disease and cancer towards the sustainable benefits that occur with our biometrics, that's like your blood pressure, your weight and such, and lab values. And first off, there's a reduction in inflammation. And inflammation is at the root of most of our chronic diseases, and it's also at the root of much of the aging process itself. And then there's the drop in cholesterol, often to levels where we don't see heart disease at all. And number three is the improvement in our gut biome. Whole food plant-based promotes a transition to populations of gut bacteria which don't promote either heart disease or colon cancer. And there's also a dramatic drop in diabetes. And an area where many people are confused is that of getting enough protein. And I think that a lot of that studies have repeatedly shown, and professional dietary organizations espouse, that whole food plant-based provides a proper amount and type of protein intake. And I think we've all heard enthusiasts comment that they don't think whole food plant-based provides enough protein. But in fact, it's estimated that the population in the United States, we eat too much protein, not too little. And there is a danger of overdoing protein because it can harm your kidneys. It can promote osteoporosis, and it's simply not necessary. So athletes like Olympian Carl Lewis, Serena Williams, and Tom Brady are certainly good examples that plant-based nutrition can provide adequate protein to perform at a very high level. Are you a Brady fan?
I am.
I suck. He's the oldest quarterback at practicing or playing at his level in the history of the human sport. Then number six is blood pressure, which also improves with whole food plant-based. And lastly is the topic of your genes. And we're born with over 20,000 genes, but not all of them are active. Some genes are turned on and at certain times, and they're turned off at other times. And our dietary patterns actually have been found to be the most important influencer of whether genes are turned on or whether they're turned off. And we can talk more about it later, but suffice it to say that whole food plant-based diets have generally beneficial effects on gene activity. They turn the good ones on and the bad ones off, whereas meats, refined sugars, and processed foods generally have harmful effects. And it's not like just a few of us have harmful genes and the rest of us have good genes, because because we all have harmful genes within us. And so what we want to do is we want to adopt diets that keep those suppressed and keep our good genes working. And the last issue on whole food plant-based I want to address is the no oil. And no oil in part is because oil has a lot of calories in it, and when they want to get down to 10% calories from fat, which is the nutritional pattern that they reversed heart disease with, they've got to eliminate oils. And oils, they all inhibit the dilation of our arteries, and they also damage the endothelium, the lining of our arteries. And when they do that, they promote hardening of the arteries, and that's why we recommend no oils. And people say, is extra virgin olive oil better? And yes, it is a little better. It's from a plant, it's monounsaturated, but it's still not good for your heart. And it's not a whole food, it's a processed, not highly processed, but it's a processed food. And so if you do use it sparingly. Now let's go through some of the popular diets, and we'll start off with keto. Even though the European Society for Cardiology and the American Heart Association classify it as harmful and to be avoided. The keto diet is very low in carbohydrates. carbohydrates and is very high in fat. So you lose weight on this diet by restricting calories and carbohydrate, and you're supposed to pee on a urine dipstick every day to make sure that you're spilling ketones in your urine. And ketones in your urine are just a marker that your body is burning fat. So you're, if you're burning fat, you should be losing weight. But the fats that you eat on a keto diet promote prediabetes, diabetes, and some cancer. So I look elsewhere for a healthy diet. So then there's paleo. Well, there's a romanticism, even a biologic plausibility surrounding the premise of paleo. That presumably the paleo diet is based upon what we ate from an evolutionary standpoint. And I think most scientists would agree that if we look at diets that developed as we evolve, they're likely to be the healthiest. But there's major holes in paleo diet as it's marketed. First off, paleo is not a high fiber diet, largely because there's no fiber in animal foods. And also, meat is a large part of paleo. Yet anthropologic studies show that Paleolithic man ate diets extremely high in fiber, way, way higher than what we are even recommending today. And then grains are excluded from paleo, yet anthropologists tell us that Paleolithic man did indeed eat grains for at least the last 100,000 years. And then the animals which Paleolithic man ate are all extinct. But they were very different from the animals that the paleo folks eat today. These extinct animals had about 7% fat, and most of that fat was polyunsaturated, whereas the meat, that the industrialized meat that we eat today is 40% fat, and most of that fat is saturated and promotes heart disease. So the paleo enthusiasts say, well, just substitute grass-fed beef and avoid industrial meat because that's the healthy version of paleo. But that falls apart because it does help to some small extent, but it's not sustainable. It's estimated that if we all switched to grass-fed beef, we would need 2.5 births to feed us. So that doesn't work, and so it's even less sustainable if we look at just eating wild game. So I'd say paleo is some better than standard American, but it's not that healthy, and it's certainly not environmentally sustainable. And then there's the low-fat, high-carb, the low-carb, high-protein of Atkins and South Beach. And these low-carb, high-protein diets can certainly cause weight loss, but they appear to be associated with an increased risk of our number one killer, which is heart disease, which, by the way, is something that Dr. Atkins himself had. But he said it was from the virus. And I should mention that South Beach actually isn't as low in carbs as Atkins, and the fats that South Beach promotes are a little bit healthier than Atkins, but I generally classify South Beach just as a healthier version of Atkins, but still not a healthy diet. And then there's the American Heart Association's DASH diet, the diet that was developed to stop hypertension, and it's pretty good at that. It's high in whole vegetables and fruits, but whole food plant-based actually beats it on hypertension control. And because DASH includes meat, I suspect this future long-term studies with it will likely show what other studies have shown, which is if you have meat and dairy in your diet, there's going to be an elevation in your risk for colon cancer and heart disease. And then there's the new Weight Watcher diet, and it's a new look, a new formulation, which is very similar to a Mediterranean diet. But Weight Watchers continues to have a business model of selling you a subscription, which ranges from $12 a month to nearly $50 a month if you sign up for telephone coaching. And that's before you buy any of their meal plans or products. So it's not that Weight Watchers is terrible, it's just expensive, and it's less effective in avoiding chronic disease than whole food plant-based. And speaking of Mediterranean, let's talk about that. One of the issues I have with Mediterranean is that there are over 15 different versions of it. So it makes studying it and figuring out which one we're talking about confusing and complex. But there are articles that certainly establish that Mediterranean is better than standard American diet. And that's because Mediterranean emphasizes whole foods, fruits, vegetables, legumes, and avoiding refined sugar. And the various versions, these 15 different versions of Mediterranean, differ from each other mostly in the amount of olive oil they recommend every day, or the frequency and the amount of the meats, eggs, or dairy. So some experts do believe that Mediterranean is the most adoptable diet for a diverse population because it's less of a change for people. With all the different versions out there, people can and do stray from the more beneficial side of the whole foods and the whole plants and legumes, and they migrate over to the worst part, more meats, eggs, and dairy, and then they in their minds think that they're simply transitioning to a different version of that. They're still on the Mediterranean, but it's not what they were eating before. So Mediterranean just isn't my favorite thing. And then there's Whole30, which has some merit from the standpoint of promoting whole vegetables and fruit, but it's a 30-day plan. It doesn't continue, and it actually promotes other foods that are high in saturated fat, like ghee, and it excludes foods which are proven to be beneficial, like grains and legumes. So it's not a long-term dietary plan, and some of the inclusions make it suspect for its helpfulness. Okay, so that was the top 10 diets. And I want to move to the topic of alcohol, because this causes a lot of controversy and questions. Also, maybe everybody's going to leave after us. But actually, alcohol has been declared, we've known it's harmful in certain amounts, and the World Health Organization recently came out saying that no amount of alcohol is safe. And they said this in the face of a number of studies that show benefit in small to moderate amounts of alcohol. And alcohol is specifically included in the Mediterranean diet, so who's right? Well, actually, I don't know who is right, but when we have multiple studies where the results conflict and they're large studies, that means that the differences are small. They're not huge differences. And there's certainly clear association of increased risks of cancer, liver disease, and dementia with high alcohol consumption. But there are other elements of wellness that we have to think about beyond diet, things like stress and connectedness. These factors need to be considered because alcohol is usually consumed as part of a social gathering, a time when friends are getting together, enjoy each other's company. That reduces stress. It can help with sense of purpose. So, if alcohol is used in small to moderate amounts in social settings, and the negative influence may very well be outweighed by the positive influence of the social gathering. So, bottom line, small to moderate, not daily, and probably it's not going to affect your longevity. So you get a pass.
How much is a serving?
Oh, they said how much is a small amount? Well, it's listed as one drink for women and two for men. And I said before, well, I'm not really sure why the men got two, since there's some that are pretty much equal size. So it's put in one to two drinks per day. And not beyond that. But I want to move back to whole food plant-based in the context of our deteriorating environment. And most of the meat that we eat today is industrially produced. And that means scenes like the one on beef and hogs and chickens in feedlots. And first off, the animal waste that's produced from these feedlots isn't processed like human waste. The runoff from this animal waste, along with the fertilizers and the pesticides that are used to grow food to feed the animals, contributes to 80% of the nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in our streams, rivers, and coastal areas. And the nitrogen and phosphorus is responsible for these oceanic dead zones that are enlarging, and for red tides, which frequently foul the beaches of Florida, the Florida Gulf. Then secondly, is the issue of fresh water consumption. It takes almost 1,800 gallons of water to produce a pound of beef, whereas a pound of grain takes only about 100 gallons or even less. And thirdly is the carbon footprint of our industrialized meat production. This carbon footprint is roughly equal to the carbon footprint of our entire transportation sector, so that's cars, trucks, trains, and planes. So we can easily and quickly reduce our carbon footprint by eliminating meat and dairy. We don't have to wait for governments to take meaningful action on climate change. A significant part is on us, and it's within our control. And then lastly is the ethical issue of how we treat these creatures in the crowded places of the feedlots. So let's move on to seafood from the oceans. One of the methods we have of harvesting this seafood is by trawling, where we essentially scrape the bottom of the sea to get the species of fish we want. And the problem with this is that 70% of what we bring up isn't the species that we are targeting, and it's called bycatch, and it's discarded back into the ocean, often dead or damaged. And we trawl on a huge scale. Each year we trawl an area that's 150 times larger than all of the global forests that we clear, but it's underneath the surface of the ocean, so the public doesn't know much about it. And this is a satellite view of a fleet of bottom trawlers scraping the bottom of the mouth of the Yangtze River in China. And somebody asked me last time, well, what are those little dots? Those are the boats that are pulling that. So you see that big plume of sediment that follows them. And it's really, I mean, you realize the scale of this, it's pretty bad. Another damaging method for getting seafood is longline fishing. And they have fishing lines as long as 100 miles, baited with thousands of hooks. And they tow them behind boats. And seabirds are caught as well as fish. And largely because of this, today, every albatross species is endangered. And there's been a huge decline in the number of predator fish being caught now compared to 50 years ago. And the long life of these predator fish means that renewal of them is going to be very slow. And then there's the ethical issue of we're depleting our oceans of fish by these industrial scale methods, and small poor countries where subsistence fishermen are really just trying to feed their families, they're finding it harder and harder to get a decent catch. So they have to go farther and farther out to sea in rickety boats. They don't always return, and it just doesn't really seem right. And so aquaculture is promoted as being the antidote for this, but it's much like industrial beef production. Small fish are netted. They grind them up into fish meal to feed the aquaculture species. Then they have to add antibiotics into the feed because of the overcrowded conditions. And the oceans are polluted by the concentrated excrement of these fish farms. So, sum up, you can see there are multiple reasons that whole food, plant-based, no oil is likely the most effective approach we have to health, to weight, and to our environment. And let there be no doubt, I personally believe whole food plant-based is the best. But that said, I am, and I have to be somewhat tolerant of lesser diet approaches, as long as they're moving people away from our standard American diet. Sometimes lesser approaches or incomplete adoption of whole food plant-based is a stepping stone. And complete change will come as circumstances change. I think we all have to do what we can do and do the best we can, but let the truth of science be our guide, not prophets or fads. And let us also not forget that little is learning. So it's been shown in the United States, 90% of people don't like to cook. And so that's why we're having this workshop, not only to introduce techniques which can make cooking fun, but also to demonstrate and teach that cooking plant-based is something we all can learn to do. So I'm going to end it here, turn it over to your expert teaching team. I thank you for your attention. I think we have a couple minutes for maybe two questions or so, if anybody has them.
Is there any questions for Dr. Berger?
Yes.
Gluten sensitivity is huge now. I mean, you see it all over. When I was a kid, I never heard of it. And what that has to do, I think, is inflammation again. And so the inflammatory diet that we're eating makes us more sensitive to it. I think that when you're on whole food plant-based, you won't have that gluten sensitivity because it promotes a gut biome that produces a molecule that helps the gut cells form tighter junctions so it's less leaky, and these gluten proteins in wheat, barley, and rye don't get into the bloodstream. They don't cause that inflammation. So we certainly see a lot more of it today, but there's a logic to that, and I don't think it's something like once gluten sensitive, you'll always be gluten sensitive, unless you have the true celiac disease, which is 1 in 1,000 or so.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
What about some of these meat substitutes? Too processed? Like the soy based coming to
food? Well, I think you have to look at, you know, processing, whether it's processed plants like white flour or sugars, those we want you to stay away from too. So I'm sure it's better than the meat protein itself. However, I think it's better to try to adapt to the diet itself than try to find something that tastes like something you remember. Okay.
All right, thank you, Dr. Berger.